You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Last week, the first debate of the Republican primary opened with a song and a question about the song by country performer Oliver Anthony. The song became a viral success seemingly out of nowhere.
His lyrics speak of alienation, of deep frustration with the state of government and of this country. Washington, D.C. is about 100 miles north of Richmond.
There's Richmond north of Richmond, Lord knows it all. Just want to have total control. Want to know what you think. Want to know what you do. And they don't think you know, but I know that you do.
The popularity of Richmond north of Richmond comes not long after the controversial music video for Jason Aldean's Try That in a Small Town went viral and achieved success, especially on the political right.
Try that in a small town. See how far you make it down the road. Around here we take care of our own. You cross that line, it won't take long for you to find out. I recommend you don't. Try that in a small town.
We're taking a look at why country music has been at the center of politics lately and what it can tell us about the genre and our political climate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a country music fan? What do you think of Oliver Anthony's viral hit? How about try that in a small town? What kind of values do you see expressed in the country music that you listen to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Our next guests are co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review. Charles Hughes is a music writer and historian and director of the Lynn and Henry Turley Memphis Center at Rhodes College. He was born and raised in Wausau and is a UW-Madison alum. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's always great to be on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for having me.
And David Cantwell is a music writer, author of the book The Running Kind, Listening to Merle Haggard. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on. I'm from the lower Midwest down in Kansas City, but it's great to be up here with you guys.
You're from the neighborhood, David. We'll accept that for sure. Now, David, at the beginning of August, we saw the top three spots of the Billboard Hot 100, three country songs. I think for the first time in history, we had Fast Car by Luke Combs. We had that Try That in a Small Town, and then Morgan Wallen was up there as well. Before we dig into the politics, what do you make of that trifecta for country music?
Well, I'd like to celebrate it, but I don't think you can separate it from the politics. It's all three of those songs in their different ways, especially the Aldean, Try That in a Small Town, and the Morgan Wallen song, I think are totally, not totally, I take that back, but largely driven by people who are not necessarily country fans trying to boost a particular political agenda, seeing an opportunity to do that, and sending them to the top of the charts through streaming.
Charles, we have these political back and forths over the Oliver Anthony song in particular and the Aldean song and video. This isn't the first time, you know, country music has taken political stands and become political controversy. Does this seem different this time around to you?
In one way, no, because country music, like a lot of cultural forms in the United States, especially those that have been predominantly identified with white people, have always had a tense, if not problematic, tendency to, you know, to demonstrate some of the more problematic and even vicious dynamics in American politics. And certainly, even in its less malicious ways, you can hear things in those songs that are tapping into the anxieties and the anger and a lot of things that you've heard in country music for a long time. You hear a lot of other things in country music too, which maybe we can talk about. But in another way, it absolutely feels different in the sense that something seems to be kind of happening right now, whether it's just coincidentally or whether it's more coordinated, in which after a couple of years in which country music seemed on the mainstream level to be perhaps kind of opening up a little bit, thanks to the insistence of artists and fans of color and also queer and trans artists and communities. It seems like in response to that now, we're having this kind of resurgence of the angry white men not only who are kind of staking their claim again to be at the center of the country conversation, but also are really exhibiting a lot of the kind of markers and shorthand and dog whistles that we hear in this particular moment on the right. And another part of that has to do with what David just said, which is this is being fueled not just by streaming and by the digital world, but by a particular set of right-wing media figures. And I think that that's really crucial. That's something that maybe could have happened in earlier generations if such technology existed. But certainly it's happening now, and it's making this moment, I think, a much more amplified situation.
Now, Oliver Anthony, we heard a bit of his song, Rich Man North of Richmond, embraced by conservatives, Republicans playing it to kick off, or Fox playing it to kick off that Republican presidential debate. Now, Oliver Anthony said, well, hang on, guys, here he is in a response video. Try to create some distance, I think, from conservatives promoting his song.
It was funny seeing it at the presidential debate, because it's like I wrote that song about those people. You know, so for them to have to sit there and listen to that, that cracks me up. but it was funny kind of seeing the response to it. Like, that song has nothing to do with Joe Biden, you know? It's a lot bigger than Joe Biden.
David, you wrote a piece for Time Magazine looking at the rise of rich men north of Richmond. Could you talk a little bit about how it was embraced and then what we just heard from Oliver Anthony there?
Well, I think that what we just heard from Anthony is a good example of, you know, what's happened. He's trying to distance himself from Republicans. But then as soon as that exact interview was retweeted by Ted Cruz and favorably saying, it's just like Ronald Reagan said, government is not the solution to your problem. Government is not the solution to your problem. Government is the problem. And it's also emblematic of this entire, I think, Trump era moment when people are constantly sort of trying to say neither Republican nor Democrat. It's what we want to do is tear the whole thing down. And so I think that that's a big part of it. One of the things I would say about his song that I tried to emphasize in the piece was that one valuable thing about it, potentially about Anthony's song, is that he tries to foreground class. He sings about lousy wages for soul-robbing work, jobs you hate but just need the same. Need just the same is like something that country used to do all the time. It specialized in it. But this century, country, and this is especially true of the mainstream subset of country music, has tended to focus on the signifiers of blue-collar culture and instead left the economic troubles behind. So people sing about nowadays living in a small town and driving a truck and drinking beer or tequila, but there's rarely any sense that anyone has to actually get up and go to work in the morning. And so that Anthony is recognizing that is, I would like to see more of that on country radio. But then he immediately pivots to punching down in this punitive way against people who are on welfare, people who he thinks are overweight, people who he thinks don't make good choices with their dollars. And that's a classic trap. That goes back to the Reagan era welfare queen with all its ugly racial implications, and about trying to pit one group of struggling folks against another group of struggling folks and making sure that the rich men are the ones who just get richer while the poor people get poverty.
Talking to music writers David Catwall and Charles Hughes, creators of the music newsletter No Fences Review, looking at some political controversies on a couple country music songs, country music hits. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rob is with us in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hey, guys, thanks for the topic. I really appreciate this because, you know, I've listened to the Jason Aldean tune. I know that Jason was on stage in Las Vegas when that mass shooting occurred, and I know that he was impacted greatly by that. And I'm not sure, just exactly without hearing it from Jason Aldean, what his message really is in that song. I do advocacy work in the community, people of color. I'm in Wisconsin. I've gone into small towns where black men have inexplicitly been killed and no one was ever charged. And I have listened to that song, and for me, it's got a double meaning. I look at it and go, try that in a small town is kind of like, that's the most likely place for a police cover up. So any idea if any of you have any input into what Jason may have thought about in that song? Maybe he didn't even write it.
Rob, thanks for the call. And Charles, I think Rob is correct. That was written for Jason Aldean, not by Jason Aldean. Right. But your thoughts on Rob's thoughts about small towns of Jason Aldean.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that call. Thank you. Thank you, Rob. I mean, Aldean didn't write the song, which doesn't really matter because in a sense, you know, Nashville country, like a lot of popular genres, has always been about a relationship between individual songwriters and performers, right? The only reason it does matter is when Aldean kind of starts talking about how this is this true expression of his belief, you know, like it does beg the question of, okay, the song was written and then you recorded it, right? But I think absolutely that there is a signaling going on with Try That in a Small Town that speaks to what Rob was talking about. Now, of course, one of the things that it also, you know, there's a lot of folks from small towns and, you know, Wausau's not a tiny town, but it's not a huge place either, right? Like, and like, you know, small towns are also not necessarily the only place, certainly, where this kind of violence happens. But there is something really, I think, very telling and dangerous about the rhetoric that Aldean employs in this song, because it taps into a much longer historical usage of this separation, the supposed separation between this peaceful small town and the crime-filled big city. And it goes back earlier than country music and more and wider than country music. I mean, in a sense, this is straight out of how in the 19th century, blackface minstrelsy, which was, you know, an incredibly popular form of theatrical entertainment, including especially in the urban north, right, kind of harkened back to this supposed bucolic, sweet, sunny south of the old days, right? And that was accompanied by this implicit and sometimes explicit threat that if anybody came in there and caused trouble, which included things like, you know, trying to push back against injustices or trying to do things like that, that they would face violence. So to me, what Aldean's message is pretty simple. It's pretty clear. And I think beyond the connection to the history, the other thing that, you know, even before I saw the video, which was just odious in the way that it employed, you know, perfectly legal, constitutionally protected activity as being things that supposedly had to be taken care of in the small town. Even before I heard that, you know, I heard lyrics about how, oh, if you, you know, come to a small town and try to, you know, defy the police, or come to a small town and try to do the drug dealing. And like, those are signals that I remember hearing growing up in Wisconsin that were very clear racial shorthand. And also now, you know, when you're talking about the police, that is purely existing in a post Black Lives Matter moment. So I'm not sure what his message is, but I think he's been pretty clear, and I think the song is pretty clear, that it is absolutely the kind of threat or the kind of promise, maybe, that Rob is accurately recognizing there.
Rob, thanks for the call. We're talking to music writers Charles Hughes and David Cantwell, co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review, looking at trends in country music, how they reflect and interact with our current political landscape. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want your favorite country musicians to take political stands one way or the other? Have you followed some of the songs we're talking about? Maybe talked about them with members of your family, your friends, or coworkers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with music writers Charles Hughes and David Cantwell, co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review. We're talking to them about how American politics are reflected and influenced by, maybe, country music. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, David, you mentioned earlier there are other themes out there in country music, other voices. I want to give a listen to one here. Tyler Childers, who wrote this song in the wake of the 2020 George Floyd protests.
It's called me belligerent. It's took me for ignorant, but it ain't never once made me scared just to be. Could you imagine just constantly worrying, kicking and fighting, begging to breathe?
David, country music isn't just conservative voices. Can you talk about the varieties of perspectives out there?
There's quite a bit. Now, that Tyler Childers song is fantastic, and he's one of the few, who's really come out and tried to sort of say, okay, these are my people. A lot of them are conservative. I'm going to try to, you know, just talk to them in a song about the very things that they're concerned about. And so my hat's off to him. He also, as your listeners may know, recently released just a straight up love song. But then when he chose to make a video of it, he made it two working class men, two miners who fell in love with one another. And that is an actual, in this moment when there's a lot of, I don't know, to use the buzzword, toxic masculinity, which I hear definitely in the Jason Aldean, and I hear definitely in Oliver Anthony and so many others, you know, to hear him sort of push back against that, I'm really impressed by Childers there. I wish more country artists who are associated, at least in the popular imagination, with the left or the liberal side of the American political discourse would speak up. Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, people like that, mostly they've kept their mouths shut. A lot of artists, though, are doing a great job talking back to that. I think one of the things I know Charles and I wanted to do today was to sort of just, like, you know, as much as we can, just like list all of the artists that are off, all of the country and country adjacent artists that are making progressive and excellent music. I'll start that list if Charles wants to join in, but like Luke Combs, his Fast Car hit is a version of the Tracy Chapman mm-hmm. Fast Car song. One of her great descendants is Joy Ladekins, and her album this year, Proof of Life, might be my favorite album of the year. It's not going to get on country radio stations, but it's that's not because of how it sounds. Mm-hmm. Britney Spencer, Tanner Adele, your readers, listeners may know Brandy's Clark and Carlisle, Yola, Amethyst Kia, Dia Victoria. I could go on and on. Charles could too. This is one of the things that all of this controversy around these right wing talking points that get brought up in country obscures is that this is one of the great moments in country music history, and so much of it is out there, and no one is really talking about it as much as they could be. My own personal like dream of a country radio format would be one that is, you know, egalitarian, that is multiracial, democratic, right? And it's there. If you get off the radio and begin to listen to all these other, some of those artists I just mentioned, and so many more, it's right there. It's happening. It's taking shape. And whether it turns into a genre of its own or it gets melded into the country music as it's popularly known, this is all, I'm not optimistic about any of that happening, but for music fans, you know, it's happening right now. This is such a fiercely an exciting moment in country music.
Charles, before we go back to our college, do you want to add a couple names to David's list?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and David is 100% right. And yeah, I mean, this is such a great time for country music, and this is such a great time to learn about country music that you through ways other than the radio or through ways other than the kind of standard channels. You know, a couple names who immediately popped to mind. I absolutely amen all of the artists that David named. I want to shout out Adeem the Artist, who is an incredible singer-songwriter whose most recent album is just really powerfully affecting. You know, I do want to acknowledge people like Maren Morris, who is one of the few kind of mainstream successful country artists who is really fully in that mainstream space, who has been really, really assertive and active, and sometimes at the, you know, to the detriment of her image in terms of country music. You know, Jason Aldean has previously said some very nasty things about Maren Morris because she had the audacity to suggest that trans rights were human rights. But she's fantastic, and her colleagues in the High Women are great. Boy, I could, there's a great new album that just came out by a group called One, the Duo, W-O, or O-N-E, the Duo, that is this amazing country pop record that is not only a really incredible duo of Black women, but is one of them is the RZA's daughter from the Wu-Tang Clan, and the other is a Wu-Tang former backup singer, and they just made an incredible country record that ought to get played everywhere, and it won't. But there's so much good stuff, you know, and so many amazing artists who are not only pushing back, but pushing out, pushing like, you know, insisting on that big tent, you know, what the great bluegrass artist Molly Tuttle calls the big backyard. And it's a wonderful time to be a fan, even as it's also discouraging in some ways.
I want to bring on one more caller. Joe is with us in Watersmeet, Michigan. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joe?
I wanted to say that I believe you guys have the meaning of Aldine's song completely wrong. And I believe what it is about from friends that I've talked to. I have black friends. There's an Indian tribe that lives in my town, and I am from a small town. I've been in a small town for almost 50 some years. And I come from a town population of about 800. And everyone that I've talked to have said, you know what, Aldine is correct in the meaning of his song as far as we will stand up for anyone and everyone. It does not matter what their race, income, if they're black, Asian, Indian, it does not matter.
Joe, thanks for the call. We just have a few moments left. Charles, Joe has a different read on the meaning.
Well, very quickly, that's not what the song says at all. And I mean, I certainly think people can hear things in it, but that's not what the song says. The song says that if you come into a small town and cause trouble, we will deal with you. And I mean, I certainly don't want to take away from Joe's experience or his black friends that he has. But the reality is when you hear that song, I think there's a very clear reason why when a lot of people heard that song and saw that video, what we immediately thought of is the violence that he says over and over and over again. So while I think there's plenty of space and wonderful songs about that small town community, I don't know that Jason Aldine is suggesting that in the song or the video. And I kind of wish that what Joe is talking about was what Jason Aldine is talking about.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Charles Hughes and David Cantwell. You can follow their work at No Fences Review. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Saturday, an assailant opened fire at a Dollar General store in Jacksonville, Florida, shooting and killing three black customers before taking his own life. The perpetrator was a white male in his 20s who came to the scene wearing tactical gear and carrying an AR-15-style rifle and a handgun. Authorities say he left behind documents detailing the racist motivation for the killings. Here's Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters speaking at a press conference.
The Clay County Sheriff's Office, who has been assisting our agency with this investigation, received information after the shooting that the shooter had authored several manifestos, one to his parents, one to the media, and one to federal agents. Portions of these manifestos detailed the shooter's disgusting ideology of hate. Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. I want to be very clear that there is absolutely no evidence that the shooter is part of any large group. We know that he acted completely alone. This is a dark day in Jacksonville's history. Any loss of life is tragic, but the hate that motivated the shooter's killing spree adds an additional layer of heartbreak. There's no place for hate in our community, and this is not Jacksonville.
The authorities say the gunman acted alone. The shooting is part of a broader movement of extremist violence that's taken hold around the country and the world over the last decade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you feel when you heard the news out of Jacksonville this weekend? What kind of action would you like to see the government take when it comes to hate crimes and extremist acts of violence? Do you have questions about extremist movements in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Heidi Byrick is the co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We heard Sheriff Waters there making a point saying that the Jacksonville shooter acted alone, which is technically true. But as someone who studies the white supremacist movement, how people influence each other online, what is your reaction to that?
Well, it's clear he took the act on his own. What we don't know, but can probably speculate, is that he was reading, you know, racist material, hateful material, which is all over the web and which has inspired so many mass killings recently. People will remember the shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo last year. But also there was the recent incident where a man murdered a woman who put a pride flag in front of her shop in California. And he had a bunch of hateful material on his Twitter feed. This is probably the process that went that happened here, that somebody was radicalized into hate and then decided to do this. I think it's also interesting that in this case in Jacksonville, the assailant was wearing a Rhodesia patch, referring to the white-run government in Africa during colonial times. The same patch that Dylan Roof, the shooter in Charleston in 2015, was wearing. So he was clearly aware of the currents in the white supremacist world.
I've seen some analysts point toward that, like there's a performative nature here where people have seen other people write manifestos and they do it in this case, want to make sure that other people see it. The act of violence is part of it, but it seems like this performance of getting the public's attention is part of the goal here.
Yeah, that is definitely the case. Manifestos play on each other, and each new shooter with their manifesto builds on the last one. That happened with the Buffalo shooter, whose manifesto was very similar to the man who killed more than 50 people in mosques in New Zealand a few years ago. Frankly, I'm glad that this manifesto never made its way onto the internet and therefore wasn't seen by other people who might be radicalized or want to one-up this shooting. These manifestos are extremely dangerous.
Your organization, the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, put out a statement about the shooting saying, quote, "We demand that politicians and tech companies take action now." Now, you just mentioned the manifestos not going online. What would you like to see from social media companies, search providers, and others that might help stop the flow of this kind of the kind of inspiration that might lead someone to an act like this?
Yeah, there is a lot that still needs to be done on online systems. You know, Facebook probably has the best policies that they're enforcing right now in terms of the mainstream platforms, but you still find hate and extremism on there that isn't caught by their AI systems. Twitter, or X now, unfortunately, seems to have completely given up with content moderation. And there's all kinds of hate and extremism on the site, from neo-Nazi material to misogynistic material. These things should not be on these platforms. But we also face something else, which there are large sections of the web that are completely unregulated now, places like Telegram or 4chan, where you can't stop this extremism from spreading and indoctrinating others. And that's a very unfortunate aspect of where we are right now.
Talking to Heidi Byrick with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism about this weekend's shooting targeting Black people in Jacksonville, Florida, and wider concerns about extremist violence, racist violence. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rod is with us in La Crosse. Rod, hello.
Hello. I'm discharged USMC in 77. Now, what really bothers me is that security guard at that college, I don't see why he didn't sit there and jump in a vehicle and follow him, seeing he knows that he put on a flak jacket, put on a mask. That just kind of amazes me that, I mean, I'm a Marine. I would have followed him, no doubt about it, no matter what they said, I had to stay there. But I would have followed him because I knew he was up to no good.
Rod, thanks for the call. Rod, referring to the security guard at a local Black college who had turned away the perpetrator. Are there things, this is at a much more up-close level, Heidi, are there things in the old, if you see something, say something vein that could also help prevent acts like this?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I don't want to second guess what happened here, but I do know that the college security folks did notify authorities after the incident. Perhaps that wasn't enough, but, you know, we can't blame them when somebody decides to do something like this. But you do... It is very important that if you see something weird that you let people know, because perhaps you can intervene. And actually the security, we don't know yet, but maybe ended up protecting the students on the college, but unfortunately not the folks who were shot at the Dollar General.
Thanks for the call, Rod, at 800-642-1234. A high profile event, excuse me, like this gets our attention now. Do we see trends over time, Heidi? Do we see the problem with particular kinds of extremist violence getting worse over the years?
Yes, in the last 5 to 7 years, there is no question that white supremacist domestic terrorism has been growing and is the number one domestic terrorism threat in this country. And that's not me saying that. The FBI has said that, the DHS has said that, the National Counterterrorism Center has said that. The federal government understands that this is the biggest threat. And of course, it's very different than, say, 20 years ago when Islamic extremism was the thing that we were focused on. So this is what the government needs to be working on and paying attention to. And as far as we can tell from testimony by the FBI director, they have put more resources towards this type of violence in recent years than they had, say, you know, 8, 9 years ago.
We're talking to Heidi Beirich, co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, looking at the shooting targeting Black people in Jacksonville last week, wider concerns about extremist violence. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about that rise in white supremacist ideology and extremist violence in the U.S.? Do you have questions about how this works? Who is inspiring who? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this kind of hateful stuff, maybe even inciting material, online? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Heidi Beirich from the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, looking at the racially motivated Jacksonville shooting over the weekend, how it connects to the broader extremist movement and racist violence elsewhere. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on how the media covers these kind of incidents? What do you think the government, if anything, should be doing to stop the tide of rising extremism? How about technology companies? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. See, so I recently have come across something online which I found extremely disturbing. And I'm maybe looking for what is the right way to report something like this. I tried making a call to the FBI field office here in Wisconsin and was put on hold for 2 hours and eventually left a message. How do I actually get this information to the right person to maybe get a look at some of this?
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Chris, seeing what he saw as potentially dangerous postings on the internet, Heidi, is there a right way to draw someone's attention to that? If so, who?
Well, I hate to hear that you were put on hold for 2 hours. It seems unacceptable. That is exactly what you should do, which is alert the FBI. And I would also encourage people to report it to the tech companies. They're all of them, the mainstream ones at least, have reporting systems, and let them know that you've seen something problematic. But it is law enforcement that you're supposed to get in touch with. So your caller did the right thing.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Willem joins us now in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've seen some sort of disturbing signs that I don't remember seeing in the past that have to do with politics. And like there's a neighbor or a non-neighbor's person in Colfax that has a sign that says lock and load, things are going to get nasty. And then claiming that, you know, the current president is a security threat to our nation and wake up America and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I think I know where that message is coming from. I find it disturbing that someone is suggesting that maybe there's going to be violence over.
Willem, thanks for the call. A lot of background noise in your call, but I think we get the gist. Heidi, Willem seeing what he sees as violent rhetoric now just on, you know, yard signs in his community.
Yeah, I mean, he is tapping into an increasing problem, which is rising political violence in this country. And if you look at polls, you find more and more people, this is particularly on the right end of the political spectrum, who are willing to use violence. And this kind of, you know, and we've had attacks, right? Nancy Pelosi's husband was attacked. Brett Kavanaugh had someone try to assault him in his home. Election officials in particular across this country have been seeing threats like they've never seen before. A lot of that driven by people who believe, you know, who are election deniers, who believe that Trump had his election stolen from him. This is a really serious situation, especially when you're talking about county and local folks who are just trying to do their jobs. And some of them have had to go into hiding at times, in particular, two election workers here in Georgia that Trump targeted. So it's a bit scary and a very serious situation. And I sure hope the authorities are prepared for maybe some tumult around the 2024 elections.
Thanks for the call, Willem. Dick joins us now in Brooklyn, Wisconsin's Brooklyn. Dick, hello.
Hi. What I'd like to say is one of the things that concerns me is the fact that we have politicians who are exalting this type of behavior. And even though they might have conservative political views, there are other candidates who also have conservative political views who aren't backing that type of thing. Yet the right seems to be exalting those candidates that support this type of violence.
Dick, thanks for the call. Heidi, political leaders, political speakers, what would you hope to hear and see from them?
What I would really like to hear, especially from folks on the right, is denunciations absolutely clear about any kind of violent rhetoric. That would be so helpful to making things better in this country. You know, from my perspective, political leaders have a responsibility to be on the right side of things. And it would be really nice if we could see, say, for example, everybody who's running on the GOP ticket say, there will be no violence, there will be no violent rhetoric, we are not going to have this at the polls or in the election process. It would be a really wonderful thing to see. And it's a responsibility and one that they should bear.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Heidi Byrick with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism about the weekend's shooting in Jacksonville. Other worries about extremist and racist violence. Heidi, I don't want to get through this conversation without talking about the factor of race. We heard the sheriff earlier being very explicit. The manifesto was unambiguous. This was a racially targeted shooting. How much do we worry about that as the center of motivation for extremist violence?
Well, it's a serious motivation, right? It's one of the oldest hateful motivations in the United States, going all the way back to when the Klan was formed after the Civil War and was the first domestic terrorist organization in the United States. We've had the shooting at the Buffalo supermarket, the Charleston church, and others. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that pretty much all people of color and Jews have been targeted by this kind of violence, whether it's a synagogue in Pittsburgh or an El Paso Walmart. We have just had way too much domestic terrorism, and also at times targeting women specifically. There was a massacre of women by an extremely misogynistic guy in, I think, 2014 in Santa Barbara, California. We're just having domestic terrorism that's out of control, that's being driven by hate and bigotry.
Heidi, we've talked about technology companies, some about things that politicians can do. What other solutions are out there that would make you feel, you know, more hopeful that we could bring these trends down in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I can't understress the issue of the online space. I just don't believe that we would have the kind of problems that we're having today if this stuff wasn't proliferating out there. I mean, in the 1990s, how would you find this kind of hateful material? How would you find a Klan group? It's not in the phone book. So it's a seismic issue. But I think there are a lot of things that can happen. One is law enforcement stepping up and also being, you know, schooled on who these groups are, what they're up to, what they're doing, what they believe. That is one aspect of protecting the public. I also think that when communities stand up, as they have in Jacksonville in such horrendous circumstances, that it does have an effect on preaching love instead of preaching hate. So it's sort of a whole of society issue to beat back these terrible ideas and make it clear that they are unacceptable in polite society, in any society.
Heidi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
I really appreciate you all having me on.
That's Heidi Byrick, co-founder and chief strategy officer of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. We've been talking about Saturday's shooting in Jacksonville, Florida, what it says about extremism and violence in the United States today. The number of elderly Americans behind bars has skyrocketed in recent decades, and costs are climbing for prisons as they deal with more advanced medical needs. As Sarah Lear reports, here in Wisconsin, that's led the Department of Corrections to open up a different kind of prison ward.
Oco Correctional is a minimum security facility surrounded by cornfields just outside Madison. Most of the inmates there sleep in bunk beds, but as nursing supervisor Rachel Snow explains, at a newly opened unit within Oak Hill, all the beds are low to the ground.
There's many of the guys that are down there that cannot navigate steps.
Wisconsin's Department of Corrections opened the assisted living facility earlier this year. On a recent summer day, the unit is busy with more than 20 inmates. Some use wheelchairs or walkers. Another does an exercise with a nurse intended to improve range of motion in his arm. Many of the men there need help with showering, dressing, or eating. And Snow says a lot of them have chronic conditions.
Respiratory issues, end-stage COPD, emphysema, cardiac issues.
There are more than 20,000 people locked up in Wisconsin prisons, and more than 15% are over age 55. That percentage has more than tripled over the last two decades.
As our incarcerated population ages, we will see a greater need.
The graying of Wisconsin's prison population mirrors national trends. Experts say that's partly because the country's population is getting older on average. But Mike Wessler, who advocates for reducing the incarcerated population through the Prison Policy Initiative, says it's also due to longer prison sentences.
In the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, there was a real focus on kind of tough on crime policies that ushered in an era of mass incarceration.
Harlan Richards was 30 when he was convicted of murder after stabbing someone in a fight. He served decades behind bars in Wisconsin before he was paroled at age 67. He says prison life is different for older inmates.
Yeah, I mean, you get aches and pains and you get medical problems, and a young guy can stand sleeping on a hard bed. He can stand, you know, the substandard food and stuff like that.
Increasingly, prison systems are responding to the needs of older inmates with specialized facilities. A federal prison in Massachusetts has a memory disorder unit to treat dementia. At a special needs prison in Nashville, inmates can be admitted to units with assisted living or nursing care. Bryce Peterson is a scientist with the CNA Center for Justice Research and Innovation. He says many people enter prison in worse health than the general public, in part because of poverty. Then, medical problems can get even worse because of the conditions within prison, including violence and poor health care.
Their physiological age is actually 10 to 15 years older than what their age actually is.
Peterson says that all has financial consequences.
The best estimates are that it's anywhere from 2 to 5 times more to take care of someone who's older than it is to take care of someone who's younger in prison.
At the same time, studies show the chance of people reoffending decreases with age. Every state except for Iowa has what's known as compassionate release policies. Those allow inmates to get out early because of advanced age or serious health problems. But Wessler, the Prison Policy Initiative spokesman, says compassionate release is rarely used.
It's a cumbersome process. It requires lots of approvals, lots of documentation.
Last year, Wisconsin granted compassionate release to 5 prisoners. Many inmates in the state are not eligible for the program, including people convicted of serious felonies and anyone who committed a crime before the year 2000. Wessler hopes for a more far-reaching solution.
My hope is that before prisons consider opening a nursing home behind bars, states will look at revisiting some of these harsh sentencing laws.
He and other advocates say the focus should be on reducing the incarcerated population to begin with. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news here on Central Time, some science, some sight. What is color? How do our brains perceive it? A neuroscientist joins the show who's been researching color, what it means, how our brains react to it, and more. And we want to hear from you. Is there a thing out there? I have one of these. I'll probably tell you about it. Is there a thing out there where you see something as one color and somebody else in your life, a spouse maybe, sees it as another color? Do you have points of confusion or argument over what color something is? If you have some form of color blindness, love to hear from you, but not just from you. You can get our conversation started right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know if you have a color that is a point of conflict in your life. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join that conversation with a neuroscientist coming up after the news. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, schools have been experimenting with all kinds of learning technologies for years, computers in the classroom, tablets, and more. Check out the state of the art as a new school year kicks off. Maybe let us know your experience as a kid, a teacher, a parent with technology in the classroom. then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. What is the most divisive food at your dinner table? The one that you love and someone else in your family hates, or vice versa? We talked about our food pickiness a couple weeks back on Food Friday with Deb Perlman. Now, here's a new survey that asked Americans about the most polarizing foods on the table. The Harris Poll did the survey commissioned by Instacart. Here are the foods that most people say they hate. Anchovies topped the list. Half of the people surveyed said, nope, I got nothing against them. I don't love them. Going down the list from there, black licorice, meh. Oysters, I don't get it. Beets, I love. Most of the people I know hate them. Blue cheese, yeah, I love blue cheese. Okra, couldn't have picked it out of a lineup when I was a kid. Can't get enough of it now. Capers, I like them. Brussels sprouts, they got better over the years. Fennel, eh, you can keep the fennel. Here is your challenge. Create a single dish using all of those ingredients. Food news you can use. This is Central Time.